Okay, so for those of you that were in this room earlier on this morning, welcome back. And for those of you that are new, welcome. My name's Rick Henderson. I'm the Chief Executive of Homeless Link and now Citra as well, which is very exciting. And so I'm one of the two co-chairs, along with my new friend Joseph, who will introduce himself.
Hello, my name's Joseph Ellis. I'm an EBE with Pathway. Here today we have Nicola Glass talking about improving healthcare for the excluded groups, a whole system approach. And we have Mark Goldup, the HGO of consultancy in Citra, and he will be talking about the shortfall in available supported housing places and the research by Citra funded by the National Housing Federation. Can you have a nice round of applause for everybody? Nicola?
Do I need to, have we pressed?
Yes, I've pressed. Yes.
Right, so good afternoon, everybody. So as just mentioned, my name is Nicola, and I actually work for Devon County Council, and I am a public health senior officer. And I'm going to be talking to you about some of the exciting work that's been happening in Exeter. But what I was really, one of the things that's very exciting is I think within Exeter we're really starting to get a really good collaborative approach to working. So, you're seeing me in front of you, but my thing's not going to work. Why is it that one?
No.
So, but it could have been a number of people that are here.
Picking away from that and then pressing up and down on the.
So it could have been a number of people that could have been here today to talk to you about this project, because one of the really interesting things about it is the wide range of collaboration that is happening in the city at the moment. So I wanted to just quickly talk you through that and talk you through some of the work that we've been doing to support that. So in Exeter at the moment, there's a number of initiatives that have sort of seemed to be happening at the same time. So the first one is... I'll just give you a background to Exeter. So Exeter is what we're going to be talking about. So it's a cathedral city. It's also got a university. And I think some of you who work around Rough Sleeping and Homelessness will know that those two things seem to be the things that create a hotbed of activity around Rough Sleeping. And with Exeter, that is certainly the exception. Exeter's also managed, I think, on the surface, it seems like, with new shopping centres and lots of developments, it seems to be a very affluent place, but alongside that is there is a growing and increasing homeless problem. So historically, back in the days of the Rough Sleeper Initiative, the initial count was 27 people that were found, which was reduced, as anyone again who's been in the business for a long time will know, it was reduced down to 2/3, and that was quite successful. But then since about 2009, 2010, there's been a steady climb up. And I think more recently, I think in January, the outreach team went out and did an early morning hotspot and found 28 people on the streets. 22 people were already using the Safe Sleep emergency beds that night. We're tending as well as the city maybe to move away from talking about people who are rough sleepers, because again, we all know that people that are rough sleeping tend to dip in and out of accommodation, but talking more about people that are highly visible on the street. So that we're sort of toying with the term street attached at the moment. So the people that we see are very highly visible on the street. So that's Exeter. So at the moment, in terms of services, this is the sort of picture we have, and somebody summed it up very well yesterday in one of the talks that I went to, that there's some really good services out there doing really good bits of work, but at the moment they're all a bit fragmented. So for the person who needs support, the current sort of service design is, especially if someone's rough sleeping or on the street, they might be met by the outreach service, who then have a job of trying to refer them and link them into a whole range of services. One of the systems that we're looking at and we've been developing over the last few years is a making every adult matter approach. So some people will probably be very familiar with that approach. It's more of a person-centred approach, It's enabling us to work. We feel it's about doing things differently, moving towards joined up ways of working, and we think those ways should be underpinned by leadership, transparency, trust and flexibility, and in order to present better outcomes for individuals and services. So we're looking at, you know, client-centred approaches, we're looking at the psychologically informed, trauma-informed kind of ways of working. Appreciative inquiry I'll come back to in a minute, and like starting to look at working from a very asset-based approach. So we've got that model that we're working with, right button. We've also been very fortunate in the city. Last year, our local CVS, were awarded some money through Public Health England's Recovery Capital Grant to develop the building that they all had already worked in into a health and wellbeing hub, and saw that it was really important to focus that around some of the work that we were doing in the city around complex needs. So our existing GP practice, Clock Tower Surgery, will be moving in there, as for the outreach service we're already in there. The probation turnaround stuff is going to have a presence in the building, and there's another substance misuse services, mental health services will all either be based in the building or have a presence in there. There will also be all the CVS type stuff that was in there to start off with, so you've got all their training services, volunteering, and then other services such as the Eddystone Trust, which is a sexual health service. So a wide range of services all under one roof. So how we kind of see that working is that if you think of making every adult matter as a kind of approach to working and an idea to start getting agencies to work together more effectively, we have a physical space in which that can start to happen. We are aware, of course, that not every service in the city that is doing good work with people that are homeless actually are going to be situated in that building. So, and also that we can have the best building in the world, but just having a great building and going, we're here, is not going to be enough to bring people in, the people that we want to access their service in. So the outside services, the day centre, the outreach services are all still going to be a really crucial part of making this work. The other bit that I think we've always stalled on, and I think probably a lot of other areas when we're looking at, you know, a making every adult matter approach and bringing agencies together, is how we get some sign up further up the ladder. How do you actually make things change? Because I think what we all feel, and I'm hearing this a lot at this conference, so I'm sure it's out there, that actually at some point it's about how we currently commission services. That services are current, you know, it creates the silos, doesn't it? And so, you know, how do we start to move to a point where we're starting to commission services that actually work across the system rather than just of a specific thing? So again, our collab is an opportunity to test out some of those co-commissioning ideas. But we need mandates to do that, and we need sign-up, and I think that's always been a stumbling block. So what we've done, luckily, is that this is just some more stuff about the collab, but I'll talk. So that shows you some of the building being developed. It's been architect designed, and actually at the beginning of it, there was a big consultation process that brought in service users and workers from a range of services to talk about what kind of centre they'd like to see and what needed to be in there. Here comes our kind of other initiative that's happening. And again, in like a lot of areas, there's a discussion in the city about how to better integrate some of the health and social care services. ICE, Integrated Care Exeter, started life really looking at hospital admissions and how people were coming into hospital, and then how, with an aim to get people into hospital, getting them out very quickly and supported in their home. And a colleague of ours who works for Exeter City Council, Chris Stocks, managed somehow to go to these ICE meetings and start raising the issue of those people who might be ending up in hospital but haven't got a home to go to, and that the needs for people that are homeless. And a little miracle happened where they listened and actually saw this was such an important piece of work, it's become one of their main work streams to look at health and homeless. So I've got some diagrams that, you know, this is a very NHS-y type diagram, as you can see. But the big bit in yellow is their work that they're doing around, or their aims around, bringing better services together around health and homelessness. And as you can see, in terms of their extra care board, they've got chief exec from the county council, CCGs, you've got people from the local hospital, from Exeter City Council. So a really high, strategic chief exec team. And to me, this is the mandate for us to be able to start doing something different, because the idea is that when a working with the clients through, so it's almost like the clients that are working through the Making Every Other Matter approach are the keys. So their experiences and where they experience the blocks to the services and the problems in getting the help they need would be the thing that we then refer back up to the executive groups to ask them to look at changing or reviewing, and also to then inform how future commissioning might happen. So it is about putting the client at the very centre and using their experience to shape the transformation of services. So in the end, the aim is that maybe the future service design might look a lot different, with a lot more pathways in and out, rather than one pathway through one team that then has to refer to all the other teams. So a lot of stuff going on, but we've sort of met as groups, and I think we've got the mechanisms in place, we've got an approach, we've got a building to test out some multi-agency working, and we've got some executive buy-in to help maybe change and shape services. But I think we also felt that there was also something else that needed to be changed. And when we started looking at Mean, we started talking about, you know, the people that we wanted to work with were maybe the people that were stuck inside or outside a service. But then we started to think that, actually, with all the best will in the world, some of the people that work in the services are probably a bit stuck as well. And some of the commissioners are also a bit stuck as well. So there's something about the system that needs to unstick. You know, a new building is great, and it's going to be exciting, but there needs to be something more happening. So one of the things we looked at was carrying out a cultural values assessment of the whole system. So what we did is we sent a questionnaire to 200 people within working within homelessness and health within Exeter, and asked them to complete a questionnaire. 75 of them did that, which, if anyone knows about sending out surveys and questionnaire results, which it again showed, I think, a real willingness to look at this within the city. So because I haven't got a lot of time, people are more than happy to ask me afterwards about what all this is about. But it's a bit like Maslow's hierarchy of need. So if you can see, all the different things sort of cover different levels. And people are basically given a list of words and asked to pick the 9 that they think are most appropriate. So first of all, what we asked is people to pick their own personal values. So within the system, what values they thought they had within themselves. And I've tried to do a little bit of a wordle here. So the bigger the word, that was the more responses I had of the word. So these were all the personal values that people felt within the system, and this ranged from people who were working face-to-face with clients to managers to commissioners. This is what they thought their personal values were. We then asked them to say what values they thought were present in the current system. Ooh. There are some positives in there. Compassion's still in there, but there was a lot of, not surprisingly, uncertainty about the future, wasted resources, bureaucracy, but also, you know, but they thought we're caring for people at disadvantage. I think blame, because we were talking about this at lunchtime in our little pod about how to better support staff, and that sometimes the difficulty with people being reflective about their practice is that we live in a bit of a blame culture still. And it's quite easy when you're working with multi-agency to, you're trying to bring together to work problem solve, and it can become a little bit of a blaming exercise, and I think that's one of the problems where sometimes multi-agency working breaks down. So this in cultural values term is called cultural entropy. So you can see the things that are sort of blocking the system that might need to change. And then we asked everybody to write down the values that they thought were needed in a new, you know, to change the system. In a new system, what is the ideal? So this is what they came up with. And I think we looked at then about some of the words that appeared in all the ones. So compassion appears all the way through. So we thought that was really significant that, you know, compassion is a really key value for the future of the services. So the next thing that we decided to do after that, we've done this exercise, we're now in the process of using appreciative inquiry to enable people within their organisations to have those conversations with each other. Because like I said, I think, you know, the old system of problem solving, trying to say what's wrong with the system, can just deteriorate into a bit of a blame. Well, it's, we're all right, we work perfectly well, it's, you know, whoever, you know, put your kind of... But, and I think in order for us to work together, we need to actually be having more appreciative conversations. So that is about what currently works really well, why does it work really well? And I think, you know, we have to accept a lot of why things work really well is because of the people involved in it, the relationships that people form with each other. And how can we make more of that? How can we create more of that within the system? So that's where we currently are. And I'm very blue sky. I think, of course, there are challenges. Some of the challenges within the city are there's also a need to look at enforcement. Like I say, there's a lot of activity on the street. But what we're trying to do is work closely with the agencies that are more concerned with enforcement. They use the word compassion at a meeting, that any enforcement or any policy has to be based from in compassion. So that's brilliant. So we're getting people to talk the same language and do things hand in hand, people, and create some consistency across the city. And that's a paper that one of our colleagues wrote, sort of looking at how we can't be offering any enforcement unless there's a plausible offer for people to have as an alternative. And that is me. I hope you come in time. And because he's on next, I think this is, in terms of my role within this, if I was to choose one in public health, is Michael Marmon was speaking earlier, who said, you know, in order to help people change lives, we have to create the conditions for them to do so. So I think part of that work is about doing this. Thank you very much.
Fantastic, Nicholas. Just while the next presentation's being loaded up, I mean, I was down in Exeter not that long ago visiting, and I don't know why I was shocked to see people sleeping rough outside the cathedral. You know, I mean, I had no, you know, I'm based in London, and you do sometimes forget that there are these hot spots around the country, but also some very good voluntary organisations in your area. I know you do some fantastic work, Homeless Link members and so on, but I like the idea of coming down to visit this new building. When's it opening?
The one side of the building's already open and operating. The side with the doctor's surgery is going to be open on the 1st of April. There will be a grand opening, so I'm sure you'll be waiting for it.
I'm actually going to Exeter tomorrow.
Are you?
My son's at the university there, so whereabouts is it? Where's the building?
Oh, talk to me afterwards. It's what Tyler has, but I'll let you know.
Okay, so there will be a chance for you to ask Nicholas some questions later on, but we're going to do both the presentations and then have a general discussion. So over to Mark.
Okay, hello. My name is Mark Goldup. I'm here because I'm an associate that works with Citra, the organisation that Homeless Link have just taken over. Citra, it was or is, I'm not sure which is the right thing to say, a membership organisation that works with housing and support providers. Is. Thank you. I knew you'd say that. Is a membership organisation that represents housing, care and support providers. And we were approached by the National Housing Federation to see if we could do a very quick piece of work for them. And they really sort of, they posed the question, is it possible to estimate the number across the country and across all types of people and all types of client groups, is it possible to get some kind of estimate of the number of supported housing places that are needed in the country? And is it possible to do that in a way that is robust and will stand up to scrutiny? And also, by the way, is it possible to do it in a month? So we said, yeah, of course. Well, I said, yes, of course. So I undertook that piece of work for the National Housing Federation, and we did produce some conclusions, and that's what I'm going to give you a brief explanation of today. They obviously wanted that, for one, they wanted that because they wanted a ballpark figure to feed into their campaigning on behalf of supported housing, because of a number of those of you that work in supported housing, you're probably aware that it's not going through the best of times at the moment, and particular proposals that the government have come forward in relation to the way, and it's terribly technical and arcane if you don't, not involved, but the way in which social housing providers in particular can set their rates have major implications and are considered to possibly lead to the possibility of half, maybe, at a conservative estimate of supported housing actually closing within the next 12 months. So they were a bit concerned about that, and so they said it would be really useful to be able to point to the government that this is how many hundreds of thousands of people need this provision. So that's what we were asked to do. I think we answered the question, yes, it is possible to do it robustly, but please bear in mind, as I explain what we did and where we got to with it, I only had a month in which to do this. So it is a little bit rusty or a bit sort of vague around the edges, perhaps. Okay, it's that one, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay, why is it important? It's important from a commissioner's point of view, I think, to be able to do these kind of estimates. Supported housing has a significant contribution to make to all kinds of care pathways, whether that's providing refuge for people that have experienced domestic abuse, whether it's about providing a stable environment for people about to enter or undertaking substance misuse treatment, or in relation to mental health, recovery pathways, etc. There are lots of reasons, and there are lots of ways in which supported housing has a part to play. So from a commissioner point of view, being able to quantify the degree and extent of need would be very useful. As I've already said, it possibly has an even more significance for those people who actually this work and this task, for those people who actually provide supported housing or benefit from supported housing because of the significant threat that currently exists. Okay. What did we do? Say, quick and dirty piece of work. That's how they described it, and I think that's fairly reasonable. I have done it before, actually, to be fair. I was responsible for, in the days when supporting people, for those people might have heard of that, days when the government actually provided money for supported housing, a lot of money, in fact, and local authorities had a statutory responsibility to consider these issues. I was responsible, or partly responsible, for developing a methodology that was used in about a third of the local authorities in England. However, I was very aware that it wasn't very good, and we had a lot more than a month in which to do it. So we actually changed the way. This is a very different for anybody, and I'm sure there's nobody in the room who's ever heard of our needs assessment methodology. But if you had, you would find that this was actually quite different what we've done this time. And we've looked at what are called flows instead of stocks. That sounds like I know what I'm talking about. If anybody here is a statistician and does this for a living, you'll soon realise that I don't really. I just like playing with numbers. However, I'm not a professional statistician or researcher. What that really means is, instead of looking at, as many of these kind of approaches do, the number of people in the population with a mental health problem, and the number of units of, so doing some kind of prevalence basis and then finding some kind of way to say what proportion of those have a housing problem, and then actually looking at the number of units of supported accommodation that are available. We don't do that. Instead, we look at people in terms of their flow through their life or flow through their pathway, if you like. So we try and sort of quantify in any particular time period the number of people with mental health problems leaving hospital with a housing problem, the number of mental health people with mental health problems in registered care who could actually manage in a lower lower care environments, the number of mental health people currently being cared at home by, I just choose mental health, it's all about mental health by the way, I just give this as an example, the number of people being cared at home by elderly parents who are increasingly unable to provide that care. And then we compare that, not with the number of units of accommodation that are currently funded or available, if we could find that out, but the number of available units. So it's actually comparing the number of people presenting over a period of time with the actual availability of accommodation, which is much, much, much lower than the total number of funded units that are available in the country. So we use a different list. Instead of looking at, there was, for people again who are used to this, something like the supporting people framework, there were 20 official client groups that the programme provided provision for. Instead of that, we actually look at events, if you like. So it's about the people leaving care, people leaving hospital, people becoming homeless, people leaving prison. It's about events, it's about flows, it's about pathways. Okay, right. How do we do it? What is our methodology? It's a four-step methodology. I was originally going to give you a handout with some of the sort of examples that back some of this up, and I decided that it would probably add greater confusion than it would clarity. But if you're really interested, you can come and get it afterwards. You can also see the report, and I'll tell you at the end where you can find out the final report. Basically, we look first of all at saying what we call our population at risk, i.e. what is the number of people who are in those situations, leaving custody without a stable accommodation to go to, leaving entering substance misuse treatment without a stable accommodation. And some of those, it's relatively straightforward. And in that latter case about substance misuse, what happens to be a monitoring system that does record that. So for everybody starting a period of substance misuse treatment of any kind, there is a standard piece of data that has to be recorded, which is whether somebody has a housing problem or not. So we can use that. In some cases, we had to be a lot more imaginative in how we manipulate publicly available data. But we actually found some publicly available data for all the groups that we were looking at, which was the risk that we were taking when we said, yeah, I can do this in a month. It was without actually knowing that that was necessarily there. But it was. But you will see, if you actually look at the handout, you'll see sometimes we do stretch the point a little bit in how we interpret and use that data. The next critical question is, though, is the next one where we identify, well, how many of those people actually need supported housing? Because, obviously, just because you are made homeless or just because you are leaving hospital without somewhere necessarily to go to or leaving care does not necessarily mean that you need supported housing. You might be able to manage it perfectly capable yourself to find alternative housing. You might just need advice and information. You might need some other form of service intervention to help you to both to find and then to manage successfully in your housing. Supported housing is a specialist kind of provision. It's not a catch-all for all people in these circumstances. So finding out what percentage of that population that are going through those kind of changes in their life is absolutely critical to coming up with a robust methodology. And that's where we find it a little bit more difficult. Because that doesn't get measured. Nobody actually measures that very, very, very kind of consistently or at all, indeed. What we actually did for the purposes of this exercise is we used a piece of data which came from the old supporting people regime that I've already referred to, when all housing support providers nationally recorded what kind of service they provided to people that came along to them. So we actually had a large data set where we could interrogate to say the people in this situation, 30% of them had a supported housing service, and the other 70% had some other sort of assistance provided. So we used that as the basis to say, and in that case we would have said 30% of the population at risk in that particular year we think would benefit from a supported housing intervention. Now that's the weakest bit of the methodology, and I'll come back to it later. We then have to compare, that then gives us a figure of the number of people in different circumstances in a year who need a supported housing service, it's called housing intervention. You then have to compare that to the availability, which is really about two processes. First of all, knowing how many units of accommodation there are, and then knowing the likelihood that those units will actually be available. And it's something like 60% of the only reliable data is the data for supported housing that's provided by housing associations, because there is still a national monitoring system that actually records that. And that monitoring system is called CORE. And for example, it demonstrated in the year in question that we took as our year, which is 2014-15, 60% of the units were not available throughout the whole year. So we had to do again some sort of juggling with figures, the sleight of hand, card up the sleeve, all that kind of stuff. We estimated the number of units of accommodation starting from the social housing sector, and we used information that we had from housing benefit logs and all kinds of things. It's all set out in the report to find a reasonable basis for the number of units. We then used stuff from Homeless Link survey, I believe, of homelessness providers to get an estimate about the turnover within units, because that actually enables you. It's because people stay in accommodation. It's not because people are just keeping it empty, you know, they're not using it. It's because people stay in the accommodation. That's why only 40% of housing association properties were available in any particular year. It's because actually people are there for a long period of time. So what you need to know is not just how long people stay, but whether the trend is changing. So if people are staying longer because it's harder to find alternative accommodation at the end of their period in supported housing, then the number of available units will go down. It's a mathematical relationship. Okay, and then that gives you the answer at the end. And that was the answer. These are the global figures. Oh yes, of course, there's 15,642 few supported housing units at, well, actually 2015-16, we said that anyway. I counted them all. It's very accurate. No. Luckily, it does end in a zero. That gives it a slightly less specious accuracy. I think that's probably purposeful. I think we've probably actually got an answer which ended in a three or something. But it always looks less, more of an estimate if you put a naught at the end. Okay. National Housing Federation was a bit disappointed with that number, actually.
They wanted it to be higher.
They wanted it to be higher. They did. Interestingly, although we did it in a totally different way, that's approximately the number of lettings in the last year of supporting people when it was being monitored nationally. I mean, it's entirely coincidental, but it wasn't an interesting kind of comparison, if you like, which showed we weren't totally wrong, I don't think. However, the very interesting, because they were more interested in, is if the current trends, and this is before anything about 50% of supported housing closing, this is before the government had invented their latest idea, we projected that in 10 years, that number would have gone up to 46,771. Now that's partly because of the increase in the population, but it is mostly by projecting the trends that are over the last two or three years in terms of the length of time that people were taking to spending in supported housing, which itself was a reflection of the difficulty of finding alternatives. So that they were much more interested in. Okay. I think, we did show, as I say, in a month, starting from scratch, that it is possible to do something that could be conceivably held to be robust. But it does need more work for it to be really of use and of value, particularly in relation to, yes, for commissioners, from a commissioning point of view, but also from a campaigning point of view. We need to check out the way in which some of the slightly dodgy ways in which we've used some of the publicly available data, make sure that we've actually included all the groups in terms of the routes into supported housing, because I don't suppose we have included all of them. We need to look at, well, how do you decide what percentage of those groups of people might benefit from supported housing rather than something else? And that really requires work on the ground. That really requires working with advice agencies, working with health or social work teams, looking at their caseloads to try and get a sense, a sample of, well, we've got this number of people who are in this situation, 5-10% of them would benefit from social housing, 40% would be looked after by their family or cope for themselves, and 30% would just really need advice and information. Something along those lines is what we need to do in a number of places to be able to build up an evidence base to make those, support those assumptions. We need to know really what the supply figure is. The government is supposed to be doing some work, which is supposed to be reporting any day, where they've employed consultants at much higher rates than me, to try and estimate the number of supported housing places there are in the country. We'll wait to see. Let's assume that they do actually come up with some answer, which we would then be able to use. But really importantly, on top of that, that doesn't tell you enough. You then need to have some idea about these trends in terms of how long are people having to spend finding somewhere alternative. Because only 1 month, actually, an average of 1 month, would put up the number needed by a 12th, I think, if my maths is correct. So that's additional work that we'd like to do. What do we need in order to be able to do it? Well, somebody to pay for it would be quite nice. Because the National Housing Federation said, yeah, that was a really good piece of work, we don't need to pay you anymore, because we've got the numbers that we need to help our... they did it too well from their point of view. They didn't feel they quite understandably, they had the number that they needed. That was fine. We also need, as I said, an important key part of the research that still needs to be done is that on-the-ground research, actually trying to find an evidence base to support that assumption about the percentage of people in particular circumstances with a housing need who actually would benefit from supported housing, because not everybody would. And it's misleading to claim that they would. That's where you can see the report. There's a report that I produced for Citra, and then there's the NHF glossy report, which they use to put their spin on it. But they're both at that address. That's me. And there is a handout which has also got that information on, so you don't have to have written it down. You can come and get the handout at the end, and it'll also give you some more technical detail for those of you who are interested in how we played with the numbers, about how we actually did that.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to throw out the room, so any questions that you have, if you can raise your hand, state your name and the organisation you work for. Gentleman in the blue.
Thank you. Leo Richardson, I'm a supported housing manager for Riverside. It's a question really for Nicola. It was really great to hear an example of a bottom-up approach, like appreciative inquiry used for effective system development. I'm familiar with it because I was involved in an appreciative inquiry, a very successful but isolated appreciative inquiry project at Riverside. My question is, I guess, I felt the frustration of working in a top-down organisation, and I think that probably applies to a lot of different organisations and systems, that I think doesn't naturally empower individuals for choice and involvement. So I'd ask, what would your advice be for us working in those sorts of systems to maybe get more or more of a bottom-up approach?
I mean, I think... you know, I could come out with sort of like the terminology, but, you know, there's something called devolved leadership, isn't there? You know, but I think there's something about having those conversations and being able to work at different levels, so with managers and commissioners, so that people working more, you know, directly with clients have permission. I think there's something about creating a culture where people feel they have the permission to step up. So, you know, that's all part of the process, and that's something. Certainly we had a sort of like a whole system summit just before Christmas after we'd done the report and started to do some of these conversations, and that was certainly one of the things that came up in the conversation there about how we create space for people to have the permission to do that.
Lady in the way.
Hi, I'm Claire, I'm working on the Handling and Homeless Health Project. I've got a short question for each of you, please. One is, Mark, has there ever been any research done on how effective supported housing is? And also, fantastic project, we'd love to come and visit that. It's really relevant to what we're doing in London, and simply learning from it. I'm just wondering what you referred to a miracle that happened in terms of getting by.
Yes, probably not enough would be the honest answer. But if you put it slightly different about effective, if you talk about the impact of supportive housing, there is increasingly work going on which is looking at certainly the impact from a kind of financial point of view, or from a point of view of does it. You know, I talked about, you know, the routes into supported housing from people coming out of hospital, for example. You know, there's work been going on about the likelihood of them going back again and whether supported housing has made a difference to that kind of thing. But the answer is not enough. But what is happening, and that was one of the things I didn't mention, is that what would be really good would be to be able to link together this kind of work, which actually looks at numbers of people in need, with some kind of assessment of what difference it makes, in a kind of cost-benefit way, but it's probably easy because, you know, in quantifiable terms, that's the easiest thing to look at. I realise that's not a be-all and end-all of whether it's effective, but so yeah, that's a kind of development that we'd like to include within the future. You'd see I've written it on my slide if you saw the slide notes, but I never looked at the slide notes, so I didn't actually say it.
I think, you know, I'm going to look at Nicola here, Nicola Forsdyke from Exeter City Council. She might be able to give you a better answer than I can about the getting the more senior buy-in. I think from my experience of, you know, working in services for a number of years, you know, I feel like I've been saying that we need to join up better and work more effectively and for so long and getting so far with it and it being thwarted because of that lack of kind of support and buy-in in a more senior level. And I think when the Integrated Care Exeter it was really looking at older people and, you know, when they present at hospital and getting them out again. And I think somehow they ended up coming and talking to Chris, didn't they?
Actually being able to provide some of the statistics was really, really clear, really, really powerful. So we asked our hostels to do a very, very quick and dirty all kind of interaction with housing care. And being able to kind of sit in the room with different GPs, people from the hospital and different services, to say that in one month, I think it was, we had 12 ambulances, and X amount of all that kind of stacked up, the whole room just suddenly went, what? And that kind of was a real kind of impact. The ability to very, very quickly put a financial figure on it suddenly made everybody realise it's not for not to do it, and they kind of really have to work together. And that kind of set within the strategic picture of the hospitals in dire straits, the councils are in dire straits, and we cannot do it alone, so we have to do it. Meant that we've got that top level line all at the same time.
Gentleman back there.
Yep. Hello, I'm Phil M, part of the EBA team. A big percentage of homelessness are care leavers. Do you work with social services on a, you know, way to try and stop kids leaving care before they get homeless? Because me, myself, I was left in the gutter, left to fend for myself. So I don't know, even one of you, is there any work you do with social services to stop that happening?
I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, with this kind of like collaboration, because I think there's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, over the last 2 days about preventing homelessness from happening in the first place. So, you know, I am hopeful. I think one of the things that Exeter City Council have done for a number of years really is have your panel, haven't you, the multi-agency panel for anybody presenting homeless. Go.
I think in essence, we'll be trying to twist it, because carelessness in many ways get two bites of the cherry in Exeter. They get the opportunity to get the person with specialist services and the adult ones at the same time. And we've created a panel of different housing providers and social workers and support workers to kind of be able to discuss individuals and help people in the right way. I don't think we fixed it at all, but we're trying to mitigate some of those impacts as much as possible.
Gentleman in the second row.
Question for Mark, Nicky, you'll probably be pleased to hear that. I'm not a researcher, and I'm certainly not a statistician, but listening to what you were saying about kind of where you drew some of the evidence from, the supported housing where it exists, looking at the old SP commissioning, looking at core returns from housing associations, well, thinking about my organisation, the Julian Housing Bath, across the South West now, and just looking at Bath, 120 beds, and only about 20% of those would come through core. Because even though we're a housing association, the rest are not owned by us. They're not owned by any housing association. Yep. You know, they're leased from others. Some of the housing associations are not. And looking at kind of the old supported people contracts, only 66% of those beds would actually come through that as well. Because others are things that we've developed in addition to supporting people funded contracts. And I'm kind of acutely aware that, and I'm just focusing on Bath because it's the city I know best in terms of housing provision, two or three faith-based organisations who might have up to 15 beds each in different houses providing supported accommodation outside of any funding structure and probably possibly unseen by your research. And that really isn't a knock on research, because pull that together in a month, I think, is quite phenomenal.
I think we probably... I think I would agree with you. I think we probably actually underestimated, rather than anything else, the number of available units. Of course, that would actually lead to a lower number. And far be it, as a consultant, from saying that I was influenced by the client in the answer that I gave. Of course not. They probably wouldn't have thanked me if it had been a much lower number. But it's not true to say, I mean, although I said core was a starting point, I think... we did have additional information from illicitly, I suppose I probably shouldn't say this, I was told to destroy it, so illicit, some information that was being used by the government inquiry about, which from housing benefits logs, if you like, extracts, sorry, is the right word. So we had some information actually about which we're able to do to use as a kind of multiplier to the social housing figures from core. Is there anybody from the government in this room, actually? All for the government. We're all for the government. I didn't say that. So we did include some non-social housing, but you're absolutely right. The numbers, that they've come about through such many and varied routes, and people have been so innovative about ways in which they're able to generate resources and things. And oh dear,
demand and need, isn't it?
Yeah,
because you're looking at a very broad set of need: people leaving hospitals, people leaving prisons, whatever else. But some of the kind of very small grassroots, often faith-based organisations have discovered other pockets of need.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
So actually, although there may be a greater number of supported units available.
I think the need's far greater. I was just, my brain was catching up with that. That probably, I feel reasonably confident that the understatements of offset each other. I mean, I actually think it is, I honestly feel it is a reasonably fair representation of the current situation, as is the fact that it's getting an awful lot worse and very quickly. Because I think we understate both. I think we understate both.
Yeah.
Just actually a comment about the care thing, which if that's a big issue people are having as a housing manager, that's quite concerning to me. In the care teams are a priority need group under homelessness legislation. So if you're getting vulnerable ones of care leavers, I would suggest the two options are sitting your housing department until they see them and provide temporary accommodation. But also, if possible, try and find out what kind of tendencies they had with social services, because we've had big issues in our area with people being given little or no notice, when they, a number of them, depending on the type of accommodation,
are still covered by the Protection from Eviction Act, and it's just being worked around. So there should be statutory services to help.
It's one of those classic things that happens where we're talking about this in the workshop this morning, where it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen. The legislation and the kind of the service responses should mean that nobody leaves care and finds themselves on the streets. And yet, people can give you dozens and dozens and dozens of case studies of where it actually happened. It's very frustrating.
The young man in the blue.
My name is John Neil. I'm with Pathway EBD. A comment from Nicola. I've been in a question from Mark. Just a comment about the hump down there. He's doing a great job. As a service user, these resources, these places we can go are just, like, I can't explain them all down. You know what I mean? They're so important. The ones that I'm used to using are on a daily basis, so it's like once a week. But there's a few of them you go to.
What we're hoping, because like I said, you know, because it's within the CVS building, that there'll be a link to some more of the, somebody called it holistic integrated care today. I thought that's what it is that we're trying to do there. So there will be like a social prescribing model. There will be opportunity for people coming in and use, you know, if they're coming in to see the outreach service or coming in to see the GP, to also take advantage of any sort of training opportunities there are, volunteering, you know, all those kind of things. They're trying to find a space to have a bit of a community garden project. So I think that's going to be the beauty of it, that it'll be able to be a springboard for some people. They might initially come in because they've got an issue with their housing or they've got a health issue, but, you know, they will be supported and have an opportunity to kind of maybe try new things.
Well, I can say, as you say that, yeah, first trying to Reiki. One of these well-being centres, I'm calling it now.
Cool.
And my question for Mark is, and this is without trying to sound too defeatist and conspiracy not here, with the welfare reforms, the introduction of universal credit, and they seem on phasing out of supported housing. I found out yesterday I was co-chairing a session, and the funding's going to run out, but we need to find more funding over the next 12 months. Again, without saying the two defeatists, do you not sometimes feel that it's a losing battle that's getting fought, and that this is a government policy that is going to be seen through to the end, to phase people like myself out of housing that could well go to someone who's paying for it?
I actually don't think, and I you might be right, but I don't think the government realises quite the impact on their specific changes that they've introduced for other reasons to save on the housing benefit bill. I don't think they had worked through what the consequences were for this particular, you know, how dependent supported housing was on the things that they changed. I think if they were convinced about the genuineness of people's of organisations, you know, protestations that yes, this will mean the end of, you know, we won't be able to provide and people will be on the streets kind of thing, I actually think they probably will change their mind at the very least to give a bit more time. I suspect they won't withdraw entirely, but they might say, well, you've got 3 or 4 years or whatever to adjust, which would help. But I mean, I don't know any government ministers, so I can't speak for them. But that is my sense. But they need to believe that it is genuine, because obviously any organisation that's providing anything is always going to protest. This is going to be, you know, it's going to hit us in our pocket or whatever. They need to believe that it really will mean that it is unviable to provide this kind of accommodation. And I don't see any indication they don't think it's a valuable service. I think they do think it's a valuable service. They just don't believe when housing associations or housing providers say, we can't do it under these rules. They say, well, I'm sorry, but I don't believe you.
Where I was going to come from is
yeah,
as a service user, are we seen as a valuable enough resource to continue throwing this money at us? And like, throw money, that's and make quite meaning come out that way. But,
no, yeah, I know what you mean. That's a more difficult question to answer.
£250 gets paid on my behalf from the housing benefit. And yeah. I think that's atrocious. Like for the little bedroom that I have,
yes,
in a shared room, it's
exactly, yes,
really atrocious. And I know it's there, yeah, for staff and whatnot, yeah, absolutely. But it's just crazy. I am Scottish, as you can hear. And in Scotland, I keep a two-bedroom front and back door house for
£500 a month. Well, yeah, okay, yeah. I don't know how I can comment on that. I think I might get in trouble.
We have time for just one more question. This gentleman here.
Thank you. Adrian McLaughlin, a GP commissioner, working with the Homes Health Programme in London. Two questions. One, can I come and visit Exeter sometime, please? And two, I thought what you presented there was fabulous at an aggregate level. What I would like is that each Health and Wellbeing Board might be able to give the current mismatch and predicted mismatch,
yep,
for that borough.
It would be perfectly possible.
My question is, yes, how close is that to happening? And guessing the answer to that, how much would it take to make that happen?
Talk to me afterwards, I think, probably the answer. But there is absolutely no reason why that approach can't be mirrored at a local level, and in some ways it's easier at a local level if there is sufficient, because the information is there to make it real, but people have to be real, think it's important enough to make that information available, and you know sometimes that's really difficult to get hold of the information. It's there, and I think it'd be easier to do the exercise that we did at a national level locally than it was at a national level, as long as there is buy-in, as it was referred to, in the other talk about, people making available time and information that they hold.
The London programme might suggest that every London borough do such a thing.
Yes, that would be a very good thing.
Yeah, perfectly possible.
I just want to come back to something that you said, and I think, yes, because you said, am I worth that amount of money?
I know, but
just in general, and I think, going back to one of, they're making every adult matter. Every adult matters, and I think, people, no matter what their background, everybody deserves a chance and everyone deserves support. And I think, that's from a humane response, from an economic response. It's either £250 a week in a hostel. How much does it cost to keep that person in hospital? Prison? All of that. So I just think, no, every adult matters, and supported housing is valuable for everybody who's able to benefit from it.
That's why I'm interested in knowing whether it is effective.
Yeah, sure.
We've kind of run out of time, and they're very strict on this, unfortunately, with us. I mean, you can go and speak to the grab these guys on as they go out. But,
yes, of course. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.